Welcome to another episode of the SaaS Podcast. I'm your host, Omar Khan, and this is a show where I interview proven founders and industry experts who share their stories, strategies, and insights to help you build, launch, and grow your SaaS business. In this episode, I talked to Roxanne Petraeus, the co-founder and CEO of Athena, a SaaS startup building modern compliance training software. In 2018, Roxanne started a new job as a McKinsey consultant and was surprised to find that even a company known for its phenomenal training used mediocre compliance training software. It sparked an idea in her mind to create better software. She started to talk to people about her idea, which eventually led to meeting her co-founder and CTO, Anne. The two of them set out to build Athena in 2019. Roxanne talked with HR folks at over 30 different companies to understand their challenges. And in a few short weeks, the duo created their MVP. Although they didn't charge for it initially, they were able to land their first customer in 4 months. Today, Athena is a seven-figure SaaS business with around 250 customers, including Netflix, Zendesk, Figma, and Notion. Almost 100,000 employees are now using Athena for their compliance training, and the founders have raised just over $50 million to date. In this episode, we discuss how the two founders have grown their business mainly from a press article and word of mouth. We talk about raising money and some of the lessons Roxanne has learned from raising a seed round all the way through to a Series B so far. How Roxanne has learned to sell compliance software without having a background in compliance or HR. The challenges the two women founders faced while building their SaaS business, which most men founders probably wouldn't have faced. And how they're adapting their business, which is currently dependent on tech companies as customers, in response to the wave of layoffs. So I hope you enjoy it. Are you looking to sell your online business or buy one to start your entrepreneurial journey? Discover exciting opportunities with Bupos.com. Bupos is the number one platform for buying and selling profitable online businesses and the first to offer built-in acquisition financing for qualified buyers. At Bupos.com, you can explore their exclusive listings, browse listings from other marketplaces, or submit your own deal for approval. Bupos can offer pre-approved financing for recurring revenue businesses, allowing you to access fast funding with no personal guarantees. And their experienced M&A advisory team supports you every step of the way. To learn more, visit sasclub.io/Bupos. That's sasclub.io/BOOPOS. Sign up today and get qualified to sell your business or find your next deal. There's a world where your CRM is powerful, easily configured, and deeply intuitive. Atio makes that a reality. Atio is built specifically for the next generation of companies. It syncs with your data sources, easily configures to their unique structures, and works for any go-to-market motion from self-serve to sales-led. Atio automatically enriches your contacts, syncs your emails and calendar, gives you powerful reports, and lets you quickly build Zapier-style automations. The next generation of companies deserve more than an inflexible, one-size-fits-all CRM. Join 11 Labs, Replicate, Modal, and more, and scale your startup to the next level. Get your free account at atio.com. That's ATTIO.com. All right, Roxanne, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Excited to be here.
Do you have a favorite quote? Something that inspires you that you can share with us?
I feel like it changes day to day, but one recently that I have really liked, I was talking to one of our early customers and, you know, in tech, and it's been a hard time in tech. And he's like, people have forgotten that leaders do work. And I was like, I really like that like leaders do work. I feel like that, sort of embodies, like, I think the leadership philosophy I grew up with in the Army, and that's been kind of motivating me and my team.
Awesome. I want to talk a little bit about your background, but before we do that, just give people the overview of Athena. What does the product do? Who's it for? What's the main problem you're helping to solve?
So Athena is a compliance training platform for modern teams. The problem we're trying to solve is that really crappy traditional experience you have where you're at a great company most days of the year, but then once a year you get an email saying, do 6 hours of really dumb, kind of boring, totally irrelevant training about everything from sexual harassment to code of conduct, insider trading, all of that. And the way we've solved it is make the training experience for employees actually enjoyable. Employees can rate our training. We have over 1 million positive employee reviews for what was historically the office's most hated training. And then for our users, which are actually HR people ops leaders, typically at companies, goes up to legal. We've automated workflows, made it super simple for them to assign, track, remind, and show, for example, regulators completion of required training.
I've got to be honest, when I was going through with my team and looking at pitches and you know, the potential next round of people we wanted to invite on the show, when I saw compliance training, I was like, no.
Right? Yeah, it's pretty boring.
For someone who's been through that in the corporate world, yeah, exactly. It kind of just drains the energy out of you. And then when I kind of started to look at what you were doing and actually trying to fix some of that, it was like, okay, no, there's something interesting here. So I'm glad we were able to make this happen. Can you give us a sense of the size of the business? Where are you in terms, you know, in terms of revenue, customers, size of team?
See, we're about a three-year-old business, about 60 employees, have about north of 250 or so customers on our platform, and it's representing almost 100,000 at this point employees or end learners on the platform.
So let's talk about what you were doing before you started Athena. Like, what's your background?
I was an Army officer for about 7 years, so served on active duty, you know, deployed to Afghanistan, worked in Mongolia and Cambodia, so very not related to SaaS at all, but good leadership training. And then I bootstrapped a business and then was a consultant for just about a year before co-founding Athena.
And you're also related to a slightly more well-known Petraeus as well, aren't you?
I am not the more well-known Petraeus, that is fair. Yeah, so my father-in-law is retired General David Petraeus, who commanded forces in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Okay, so let's talk about where the idea for this business came from. What led you to say, I'm going to go and solve this compliance training problem?
I totally hear you. Compliance is incredibly boring. I think it's just reframed as culture, because that's really what it is. It's like a culture of, do you have a culture of people doing the right thing or not? And when you talk about it that way, I think it's actually fascinating, right? Like, everybody is interested in whatever fraud is perpetrated that's on the cover of the New York Times. When Me Too was going on, like, that was, you know, captured so much attention. And so I came at it from that angle, which is like, I was a woman in the Army, and it's no secret that the Army really struggles with gender inclusivity, issues of harassment and assault. And so I just saw both really great leaders and not so great leaders and the cultures that they brought about, and thought a lot about like, what is doing the right thing look like and how do you get people to do that? And then, so that was percolating. But then at McKinsey, I was going through kind of what you described, that like, just click next, check the box type training. And I thought it was very strange, because McKinsey is otherwise known for phenomenal training, corporate learning, you know, all of it. And so I was surprised to see what I had seen in the Army, essentially at McKinsey. And it just struck me as odd. Like, there's, you know, no way that this is what, you know, good looks like. And it was really around the time that I had a bet with someone on the team that I could write really good email subject lines for what is otherwise boring emails and get more people to open them. And like, I won the bet, and it just kind of showed me like, you can make even boring topics very interesting if you try. And so then I ended up doing a little bit more research, thinking surely after Me Too, someone had come along and modernized compliance training. Like, how could it possibly be that we realized the scope of the problem? And just like, to put a fine point on it, in the years after Me Too, more CEOs were removed for personal misconduct than for financial shortcomings, meaning like, CEOs were getting removed for all of the stuff that compliance training addresses, not because they missed quarterly earnings, you know, targets. And so it's incredibly disruptive to a business, let alone like the you know, the personal cost of all of these, and sometimes the personal liability of them. So yeah, that was sort of the long and the short of recognizing that there was there had been a sea change in how we think about these issues, but there hadn't been a corresponding change in the products that are supposed to solve them.
So how did you meet your co-founder, Anne?
Yeah, I think it was like one of those serendipitous moments. I started thinking about this idea, and it was just like a real kernel of an idea, like basically like, not bad compliance training. Started talking to some founders in the New York City area, met one, and you know, I almost didn't pitch him because I thought he was the founder of this AI company and, you know, his like big deal company. And I had this like what I thought was kind of a small idea, and ended up just telling him like, hey, I got this idea. And his eyes lit up because he had said he had just had to make his whole company go through compliance training and thought it was so dumb and such a waste of time, and was like, oh, I know your co-founder. And I didn't take him that seriously at the time, so I was like, that's a, you know, pretty absurd statement. But turns out he was totally right. We had maybe two or three phone calls, met in person once, and got into business like pretty quickly, not having any like shared connection. We went to the same college, but didn't know each other there. So totally serendipitous.
You've got this idea. You've got a co-founder on board and basically your CTO. How did the two of you get started? Did you go out and talk to customers? Did you try to raise money? Did you try to start building the product? All of the above? Like, what did you do next?
We're in the all of the above category. We launched about 3 weeks after. We launched our beta 3 weeks after we like had formally gotten together. So it was very quick. And we raised shortly after that. And we talked to a bunch of customers. And the way I did that was just like, you know, have a bunch of conversations. So I'd ask somebody, hey, is there like an HR person at your office? Will they talk to me? And usually when I'd say like, I want to talk about compliance training, everyone hated it so much that they're like, yeah, I'll talk to you about it. Like I'll almost complain to you about it. It's great. And so I just had a bunch of those and I'd follow every breadcrumb. I'd say like, do you have any friends who might want to talk to me? So just like very scrappy, I kept a huge Google doc, you know, just jotted down my notes of what, you know, frustrated everybody. I was learning about the space because I'm not HR, I'm not legal. And then simultaneously thinking about the product and brain is going to work on, you know, what could a really, really scrappy MVP look like? I would say we definitely fit in the bucket of like, are quite embarrassed by our first product looking back on it. And then got it out the door because New York's city and state at the time were changing the regulations such that every company with one or more employees was required to train annually on sexual harassment starting in October. And I think Anne and I got together in September. And so we thought like, we've got to get something out to hit this wave because like maybe we can ride it and, you know, ended up being correct. But it was definitely a bit of a scramble to get something out that quickly.
So when you were talking to potential customers, HR folks, did you have any kind of structure to the conversation, the interview, you know, doing lean startup stuff or the mom test or any of this stuff? Or was it just like, just tell me about, you know, your problems? Like how did you approach that? And what did you do to make those as kind of useful conversations as they could be for you at the time?
I read the Lean Startup, liked that methodology. I think, but, you know, look back, I had a doc with maybe five questions. Thankfully, at McKinsey, I had done some work where I had done expert interviews. And so I kind of treated it like expert interviews, you know, so you go and ask a bunch of people and you can get smart on a topic very quickly if you, you know, just have a bunch of conversations and you're targeted. So I would definitely ask the same questions. I think I was like, why do you train? You know, what do you like about it? What do you not like about it? But then I would certainly follow breadcrumbs if someone kind of went off script and had something that I hadn't heard before. And I stopped having conversations essentially when it was like the marginal value of an additional conversation was kind of zero. Like, okay, they're just all telling me the same thing. Like, got it. You know, so they might have slightly different variations, but it was like, you hate it because it's a pain to administer and you hate it because your employees hate it, but you have to do it. Like, got it. And so like, I just got to that point and kept a, like, I think a, you know, Google folder or something of just all these different conversations and would try to synthesize them for Anne so that her product brain could kind of think about like, okay, this is the problem. What's the solution? Yeah, that's kind of how we tackled that.
And then roughly how many conversations did it take for you to get to that point where you were like, I'm kind of just hearing the same thing over and over again?
Honestly, it happened pretty quickly because the space we're in is very established. And so I would say like somewhere around 30 to 50, I think is probably the number that I had before I was like, you know, at this point, I would just like to be able to sell something and see if that sticks because like the problem statement has been articulated so many times.
And then so at the same time, you're building this MVP and it was the embarrassed version, which is fine. And so what did you do with this? Did you, first of all, did you charge for it from day one? Or was it more about kind of getting people to look at it and give you feedback? Like which approach did you take?
Because we were really trying to get something out very quickly, we decided not to charge for our first beta. And I want to say we had something like, let's call it 10 customers in that beta, you know, so it was free. And I'm glad that we did that approach because of just how quickly we were like moving. It sort of felt right. And I think we did something pretty like clever that at least worked for the problem we were solving, which is we talked to, in all these conversations I was having, I talked to HR at a VC fund and she said like, oh yeah, you know, I hate this. And also she was aware of the changing regulations and I can't remember if I proposed it or if she did, but essentially where we got to is like, if you guys can give us something for free, I will share it with my portfolio companies. I'm not going to make them do it, but I will send an email to, you know, all whatever 50 portfolio companies we have, whatever it was, saying, hey guys, there is this regulation. You need to know about this change. And here's a solution if you want to use their solution. And I think it had like a Google form in it, you know, sign up here. And I just remember like, oh my gosh, people are signing up, you know? And so that's how we got our first 10 was just through mostly through this cohort and then a little bit through our networks. You know, we had a friend who was starting a company. Okay, great. Do you, you know, 10 people want to be in it, that kind of thing. And that got us our first beta cohort, which really gave us some amazing feedback, both from the employee and the admin experience that we then turned into like essentially going heads down. And I think we released our actual product around, I want to say like late January, early February of 2020. And that we did charge for from day one with the idea that we wanted to demonstrate to ourselves that, hey, like someone would, you know, really pay for this. There's real value there.
How long did that take from the point you started to the first customer?
So that would probably be like, I don't know, 4 months or so, but we did pre-sales. So I remember like, you know, over the like Christmas holiday, like doing some pre-sales. So let's call it like we had existed for a quarter or so before we were selling.
What did your first customer pay you?
I should know this. I still remember like a couple of the first calls where we signed somebody. I don't remember exactly, like, you know, wasn't very much. These are like at the time it was 30 person companies that we thought like, holy smokes. I remember our first large customer, like very large customer, said, can you send over the MSA? And we had just been doing online click through, you know, order forms or something. And I immediately had to email out our network and say, can someone give me an MSA? Cause like we really hadn't been, you know, like, and all of our customers had been quite small and had been okay with the sort of self-serve flow. And yeah, so it was definitely like, oh, we got a whale that we had not been anticipating.
The third thing you said was you were also going and trying to raise some money, or you did raise some money shortly after, kind of had these conversations and building the product. How much did you raise, and generally, like, how easy or difficult was it to raise that first round?
The first round for us was actually very easy, and I never want to say easy because like fundraising is like, you know, can just be like consistent face punches. But for us, this was pretty easy. And I'll attribute that like entirely to my co-founder. So we raised from Ali Partovi's NEO fund. They have this network of engineers and they do like pre-seed, seed. I think the world of him and of NEO. And he had known Anne, my co-founder, from engineering networks. And like later after I talked to him, because I remember pitching him being very nervous, and I said, like, what did you think of the first pitch? And he's like, honestly, I don't really remember it. I wasn't paying attention. We were going to invest in you because I believed in Anne. And, you know, you passed the like sniff test, but that he had just seen her track record. And so, you know, it was easy, but I have to credit my co-founder for making that round come together quite quickly.
How much did you raise, by the way?
That was about 750K. So it was a pre-seed and it was Ali, you know, some great angels. That's how he pulled that together.
I was watching a video with you and Hunter Walk, and you know, he's another investor in the company, but he didn't invest in the first round and made it very clear how much he regrets not having invested earlier. Can you just help us kind of understand, like, that's kind of a good example of an investor who kind of eventually saw the opportunity, but at that early stage, he had some concerns that were holding him back. Can you just tell us about that?
Totally. And I can kind of paint the picture because that was our seed round that he put a small check in, but, you know, passed on leading and has since bought up and has been a wonderful investor. And I think the world of Hunter. So in no way is this me you know, talking bad about him. Yeah. So, I mean, one, that seed round was a bit cursed in that I flew out to SF the week essentially that COVID hit the US. It was like the week of the NBA games being canceled and all of that. I ended up getting on a red eye and coming back to the US because we thought like borders were going to close. Everybody was suddenly working from home. No one knew what this meant. So like, you know, I'll give a pass to everybody for just trying to like navigate that time, because that's when we were all figuring out like, what is COVID? But I think that the other thing that I've since learned is I wasn't doing a great job of pitching the vision. I was pitching the company, and there's like a distinction. And I wasn't sort of pulling forward this long-term vision. I was more saying like, look, we launched very quickly. We have all these customers and here's a really established market and here, we're going to win it. And I think a lot of investors rightfully were like, that sounds like a good business. It doesn't sound like a good venture scale business. And I think I could have done a better job of explaining, no, Anne and I have that in our heads, but what we are, like someone back channeled us once and said we were like very like sneaky operators or something. We don't posture. We don't come off as like, I'm going to crush it and change the world. Like, that's just not our vibe. We're like relentless executors. And so I think that some of that, I just didn't understand kind of how to translate that like builder me into fundraise me, not in an inauthentic way, but just in a way that was explaining, like, it's not that I lack ambition. It is that I am also very good at executing. And so figuring out that balance, I think, was something that wasn't nailing when I pitched Hunter, but, you know, he's since been able to see the executor us and been like, oh, I get it. Like, they might not come in, you know, flashy, but like they will just kind of like put up wins consistently.
It's funny you say that because I spoke to Rahul Vora, the founder of Superhuman, a few weeks ago.
Great Athena customer.
Oh, I didn't know that. There we go. And he said something similar where I think it's more for him, like, you know, I'm from England. We're understated. You know, we don't go in and say, we're going to do this. And like you said, like take over the world and stuff like that. And I think I'm the same as well. Like growing up in England, you kind of like, I always used to look a little bit like puzzled when, you know, every American person I spoke to was super excited to do something versus just excited, you know. But I say that stuff now as well. I think I've been Americanized now. Are you an entrepreneur looking to buy a profitable online business or a founder ready to sell? Bupos is the number one platform for buying and selling profitable online businesses. With their exclusive listings, as well as listings from other marketplaces and the option to submit your own deal for approval, Bupos has you covered. Plus, they're the first to offer built-in acquisition financing for qualified buyers of recurring revenue businesses, allowing you to access fast funding without personal guarantees. And their experienced M&A advisory team supports you every step of the way. To learn more, visit sasclub.io/Bupos. That's sasclub.io/BOOPOS. Sign up today and get qualified to start your entrepreneurial journey or sell your business at the right valuation with Bupos.com. Let's talk a little bit about just the idea of like selling compliance software. There's been software around for a long time. And as we talked about, it's not exactly, you know, the most engaging experience for employees to go through. I can definitely see like the end user desperate for something better, like ideally not having to do it, but if they have to do it, give me a less painful, like maybe even a pleasant experience when I use, you know, kind of go through this training. From a buyer perspective, that's the person that you need to talk to. Maybe how much of the pain did they experience from this, and how easy or hard was it for you to convince them that they needed this software?
I was very sympathetic to your point to the end user. I got that like the random salesperson was like, this is dumb. Why am I here? I didn't understand our actual buyer's pain points because I had never lived that. So I didn't understand that they were spending sometimes 10 hours a week going through like CSVs and checking against maybe their HRIS data, who hasn't done the training. Oh my gosh, all of California didn't actually get the right training because whatever, we had some glitch. And so it took me a while to learn like, oh, they have two pain points. One is that nobody likes to be the like fun police, the person who says to the entire company, you're going to do something you hate for 6 hours. But I needed to understand like why in particular is that painful. So like, I think really great sales is about discovery. And so in talking to our customers and talking to prospects, I would understand things like, oh, you get support tickets because the software crashes. So the random engineer can't even do the training. They claim they've done the training, but you can't see that it was completed. They are saying that the training was offensive because it had really, for example, gendered stereotypes in the training. So like I need to explain not just that employees hate it because employees complain about everything, but how does that like specifically, where does that pain show up? And so I started to uncover like, okay, it shows up in support tickets. Let's talk about how many and how long it takes you to, you know, deal with those. Or let's talk about risk associated with the fact that there are errors. And then they say like, yeah, that's actually like kind of a problem. And it's been flagged by our legal team. And, you know, okay, can you solve that problem? And so it just like ended up getting from general to specific. And then we could align the product with like the specific pain points and eventually show impact, not just the features.
So you've got some big names as customers: Netflix, Zendesk, Figma, Notion, Superhuman. How did you go out and get these big customers? What were you doing? You know, was this like actually it wasn't outbound, because you told me earlier that that's something that you've just recently started doing. So how did you get these customers?
Totally. So we got our first huge group of customers to include Netflix actually through press. You know, I think press can be like a really underutilized tool where maybe you just say like, we raised a lot of money, yay us. But we really tried to talk about the problem that we were tackling. So we said, for example, our first, the course that we had was sexual harassment. So we said like, hey, companies are investing a lot in inclusivity, but once a year they sit everyone down and they have this huge opportunity to explain what inclusivity looks like. Let's talk about what's right and what's wrong and what to do when you see wrong. And instead, we're all just clicking a box. Like, literally, what are we doing here? Why don't we do this thing? Why don't we take something that we have to do and make it something we want to do? So we talked about that in an article that was in TechCrunch, and later found out that the CEO of Netflix had like seen it, shared it with his legal team. And that's like how, you know, I learned about them. And I would have this very minimal CRM where, you know, people would put their emails through and I would just look and see like, oh, at big company. And I would email them and be like, hi, what do you want to talk about? And I just got on a call with them totally unafraid, because I figured like, I've got nothing to lose. We're a small company. And did discovery, learned about their pain points. Why are you on a call with me? Like, you have a lot of other things to do. Oh, you really hate your training. What do you hate about it? So like, press was one. And then once we started getting customers, the second big one was word of mouth. So like, you know, we never took a customer for granted. Like, we were just so excited to have our early customers. And so I think that like looked like delivering a really great experience, such that when they were in an HR Slack channel and someone Slacked out, hey, I've got to, you know, do my annual compliance training. Any good vendors out there? Someone would say, hey, check out Athena. And suddenly it would be like, you know, boom, boom, boom. We'd get five emails and be like, where'd you guys come from? And they'd say like, oh, Susie at whatever, you know. And then the third thing we started to get really good at is just working our network. So someone who I went to college with knew someone, and I would, or actually a great example, I was interviewing someone to be on our sales team and it wasn't a good fit, but I was like, do you want to tell your legal team about us? And the guy was like, sure, I'll tell my legal team about you guys. And that's how we got a public tech company, because just like someone we interviewed emailed their HR or legal team and they were willing to get on a call with me, and then they bought.
The press, was that just the one TechCrunch article, or was it like kind of a result of, you know, a number of these kinds of articles or whatever that you were kind of getting out there and talking about the problem with?
Initially, it was one, but we did a really good job storytelling and brand building and did the work behind it. So, for example, I wrote a Fortune op-ed about why sexual harassment training is broken. And I wrote it with Gretchen Carlson, and that got a lot of attention because like it was very well researched. I articulated like, there's research that shows at best, this doesn't work. At worst, it makes men in particular have more unconscious gender bias. This is bananas. And then some CHRO would read it and say like, this is bananas. And be like, yeah, like I'm citing studies. I'm just like marketing the problem, really. And then we can talk about my solution. But yeah, initial press moments followed up by, I think, like a smart approach to essentially being a thought leader in the space.
You know, I'm amazed that nobody has tried to build kind of this modern compliance software. I mean, maybe there are other products out there. Yeah, it just seems surprising that there are so many employees still kind of going through this painful experience when, you know, if it's done in the right way, it could actually achieve what the objective is, right? As you said, is like to hopefully make sure that you have the right kind of culture in your organization.
I mean, I think this is why like we've grown through word of mouth. Like once people are, I mean, one of the biggest ways we'll grow is even an employee, not even HR, a current customer will switch jobs and they'll just share it to their HR. Hey, I just took our current training and it's kind of bad. Like, could you please look at Athena? This is the hot take, but I think like perhaps the reason the problem itself wasn't tackled is one of the biggest, like the sort of most commonly done, meaning completed course for compliance is sexual harassment. And that disproportionately impacts women, and women don't get funded by venture capitalists. And so I think that like this problem, while the problem is pervasive from a market perspective, I think it is unfortunately the type of problem that is seen differently based on a bunch of demographic factors, but one of them being gender.
Athena is two women founders. Yes, you've been able to raise money, and I think you're at what, just a shy over 50 million now, right?
Yeah.
Did you face any challenges raising money because of your gender, do you feel?
I think there's no way to look at the stats and say that there isn't a disparate experience for women founders. And I mean, the stats are atrocious for founders of color. Like there's a bunch of different ways that this manifests, but my experience is with being a woman. And like, yeah, I had blatant examples to include, you know, VCs asking if I was pregnant or planning on getting pregnant. I saw my co-founder, who's our CTO, be sort of challenged, like, okay, but you're the actual engineer. Like there were definitely questions that she just wouldn't have gotten if her name was Tim. People would have just assumed that she had the engineering chops. And those are the things that like I see, you know, and so then the things that I don't see or that, you know, are unconscious, they're not explicit, but when you look at, you know, when you think about what a SaaS founder looks like, you don't see a team, like, you know, you just picture the archetype, you don't see a team that looks like my co-founder and I. And I think that maybe the positive side of this is that I do think that being a team that looks like ours has allowed us to attract some really great talent and kind of punch above our weight for recruiting, precisely because we build a culture where it says like, we want to have a place that, you know, everyone feels like they can show up and do great work and just like, candidly, like not have to deal with this bullshit. And that doesn't mean we're flawless, but it does mean that I think we've just like attracted a really great team. But yeah, it is absolutely manifested in a bunch of different ways in terms of raising venture capital. And I don't think you can look at the stats around, you know, less than 3% going to teams that look like Anne and I and conclude any differently, unless you think that teams like us just have worse ideas.
Yeah. And I think often, as you said, I think it's often there's this bias or people say things and they don't realize what they're saying. But, you know, it was clear to you, you pick it up. I remember once spelling my last name, and this person spelt it as K-A-H-N. And I said, oh, it's actually K-H-A-N. And this person said, oh, yeah, that's right. You people spell it the other way around. It's like, you people, right? And so it's just like, you know, when you're on the receiving end of that, you notice that, whereas the person who's saying what they're saying maybe doesn't even realize it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it shows up a lot, like words like hustle, which like, I completely understand why that is incredibly important, but I sometimes feel like I was almost, I mean, I remember someone saying like, this is a really hard thing to do. Like, why do you want to do something hard? And I was like, do you ask male founders who pitch you like why they want to do something, you know, hard? And being in particular confused because my background, like I've deployed to combat, I have jumped out of planes. Like, I'm not sure why you think that like I've had some coddled existence such that it is odd for me to express ambition here. And those are my thoughts on that.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about kind of where you are today. A lot of your customers are obviously tech companies, and we're going through some changes in tech right now. How is that affecting your business and kind of the way you look at the outlook for the coming year?
You're exactly right that our primary customer base is tech. We actually sell a lot into finance as well, finance and fintech. But it's like if you look at our logos, these are companies that have gone through like some of them 20% layoffs. Like it is a hard time in tech. I think that's like not a controversial statement. What I am so proud of is our renewals are just incredibly high, like north of 95%. We just keep the customers who join Athena. And that's been true even when we see a renewal of a company who has gone through layoffs or, you know, sort of other headwinds. And I think what it's taught our team is like, it's incredibly important to show value. And we are incredibly grateful to be a mission critical system. That is, you have to do compliance training and in any sort of like distributed workforce, meaning you've got employees across multiple states, you need an e-learning solution that's very good. And so that's not to say we sit on our laurels, because I think you absolutely need to continue to fight hard, but it has made us grateful that our entry point into the market is one that is required. You just got to, like, it's legally required. But I think that it's manifested in, you know, all of the challenges teams needing to say, like, hey, we have fewer people, and us needing to rethink our messaging and say, like, you know what, let's really make sure we show how much time we save in admin. And, like, let's just break it down and say, you used to spend all this time doing manual work, you told us this, and like, get a little bit more, I think, precise in terms of the value that we provide, because understandably teams are asking, you know, these kinds of questions.
So is your pricing, I couldn't find pricing on your website, so I assume that's because you're still testing your pricing.
It is not, but it's more of a, our website can continue to be improved. We have very standard pricing, but I hear your point.
Okay. Good to know. Is the pricing based on the number of employees or people taking the training? Is that how you structure it?
That's exactly right. Per employee per year.
So if you're seeing a 20% company with a 20% layoff, that potentially means that the contract value there could also, you know, dip.
That's totally right. Like, contraction can be, you know, and I think it's like, I spend a lot of time talking to SaaS founders with similar business models, and, you know, like, revenue contraction is absolutely something that's, like, important to keep your eye on. I think how I've been navigating this time is sort of asking, like, in the same way that a company like mine will see the good times, right? Your company grows with us, yay, their contract grows. We will see the challenging times. Company is now, you know, 50% of the employees they were. Like, that is going to absolutely hit our top line as well. Is to sort of ask myself, like, what are the fundamental drivers of, like, if we're providing value? And I mean, I think it's a piece of advice that I got 2 years ago, but didn't resonate as much then. But, like, don't ride the highs because you'll have to ride the lows. Is, like, don't celebrate kind of almost like vanity metrics or just like, yay, the economy is growing, we're growing. And instead ask, like, why do I believe that Athena will win? I believe it'll win because it's a mission critical system, but it's also now something that companies want, right? Culture and compliance. And, like, that hasn't changed. And just because of these, like, economic conditions, that might mean I need to position it differently. It might mean I need to structure things differently. But end of the day, if I can get and keep customers, like, that, you know, is the long-term drivers. And I've been very grateful for, you know, a group of investors who I think is, like, less maybe, like, twitchy than what I can feel sometimes on Twitter of just like, oh my God, everyone's software is dead. It's like, software's not dead. It's a hard time. But, you know, like, that, we just can't swing like that dramatically. It's very hard to operate in an environment in which you do.
Okay. Let's wrap up, move on to the lightning round. I've got 7 quick fire questions for you. You ready?
Yeah.
What's one of the best pieces of business advice you've ever received?
It's probably back to the first quote of just like, leaders do work. Like, pretty good advice.
What book would you recommend to our audience and why?
I really like Reed Hastings' No Rules, Rules. It's him and a co-author who I'm forgetting. I think it's an amazing book on company culture.
What's one attribute or characteristic in your mind of a successful founder?
I think it's a steady hand.
What's your favorite personal productivity tool or habit?
I'm going to go very low tech and say walks outside with no screen.
Well, what's a new or crazy business that you'd love to pursue if you had the extra time?
Oh, man. I don't have one at the top of my head, but I'm a mom and I feel like I've had a million ideas for random, like, child baby things that, like, the world probably doesn't need. But yeah.
I'm telling you, when you're a parent with a baby, you'll buy anything if it gives you stuff.
Take my money. Just like, take my money and make it stop. Yeah.
Like, will it help me sleep? Yeah, I'll pay whatever. What's an interesting or fun fact about you that most people don't know?
I grew up in Walt Disney World's planned community.
Wow. What is in Epcot?
It's basically Epcot. It's a Celebration, Florida. It's right outside of Disney World, and it was intended to be like Epcot, but people live there.
And finally, what's one of your most important passions outside of your work?
I really love working out. I am a CrossFitter, which is embarrassing to admit in public, but it brings me a lot of joy and stress relief.
Thank you so much for joining me, and congratulations on, you know, the traction and the success you've had to date. If people want to check out Athena, they can go to goathena.com, and that's Athena with an E, even though I make it sound like an A. We'll include a link in the show notes. And if folks want to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Probably LinkedIn, which I know is not where the cool kids hang out, but it is definitely where I am. It's Roxanne Petraeus.
Awesome. We'll include a link to your profile in the show notes as well. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. And I wish you and the team the best of success.
Thank you so much.
Do you dream of owning a profitable online business, or are you looking to sell yours? Bupost.com is the number one platform for entrepreneurs and founders alike. With Bupost, you can discover exclusive listings, browse listings from other marketplaces, or submit your own deal for approval. As the first platform to offer built-in acquisition financing for qualified buyers, Bupost makes it easier than ever to acquire a recurring revenue business without personal guarantees. Their experienced M&A advisory team is dedicated to supporting you throughout the process, ensuring a smooth transaction. Don't miss out on this exciting opportunity. To learn more, visit sasclub.io/bupos. That's sasclub.io/BOOPOS. Sign up today and get qualified to sell your business or find your next venture. There's a world where your CRM is powerful, easily configured, and deeply intuitive. Atio makes that a reality. Atio is built specifically for the next generation of companies. It syncs with your data sources, easily configures to their unique structures, and works for any go-to-market motion from self-serve to sales-led. Atio automatically enriches your contacts, syncs your emails and calendar, gives you powerful reports, and lets you quickly build Zapier-style automations. The next generation of companies deserve more than an inflexible, one-size-fits-all CRM. Join 11 Labs, Replicate, Modal, and more, and scale your startup to the next level. Get your free account at atio.com. That's ATTIO.com.